Welcome to the Commerce Tomorrow podcast, your one stop to learn about the technology that's powering the future of commerce. Here are your hosts, Dirk and Kelly.
Welcome to another episode of the Commerce Tomorrow podcast. I'm Kelly, and I'm joined with my co-host, Dirk.
Hi, everybody.
And today we're joined by the co-founder and CTO of The Yes, Amit Agarwal. Welcome, Amit.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We're really excited to have you. Could you give us a quick background on how you got to where you're sitting today? Your time in university onwards, career-wise, how did you get to be co-founder and CTO of The Yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a technologist and a product person at heart. And so I've really spent the last 20 years of my career working as an engineer to start off with, but also as an engineering and product leader. So very early on in my career, I worked at Microsoft, mainly on the Bing search engine. So I was one of the early engineers working on Bing when Microsoft decided to invest in search. And I was part of a team of about four engineers who started building the technology. I spent a lot of time building the core search infrastructure, but also spent a lot of time working on the algorithms and the ranking and the spam-related problems. So, we were one of the, it's an interesting anecdote, but back in the day, this was almost 20 years back, we were one of the early groups that was using deep learning for web search ranking, and we published a couple of papers, and I was part of that team. So that was super exciting. I learned the ins and outs of search and machine learning at that time. And then I went to Google, where I spent a few years working on ads. At Google, I was mostly working on teams that were building tools for advertisers. So again, using machine learning and data mining to give advertisers insights into how they should think about their campaigns, what keywords should they advertise on, what should their bids be, what should the budget be. So after Google, I went to Groupon, and I was again one of the early engineers in the Palo Alto office at Groupon, and I helped build a lot of the personalization technology at Groupon. So Groupon used to be a daily deal model where every user, every consumer in a given city would get the same deal. And so there was no personalization built into the system. And we built all the technology and really transformed the business to be more of a deal bank model, where there were tons of deals in any given city on any given day. And a user would get in their email the best deal for them based on where they lived, what their preferences were, what kinds of deals they'd interacted with in the past. So we were kind of build the core email personalization technology for Groupon. And then most recently, before starting the Yes, I was at a company called Bloomreach, where I was chief technology officer. Bloomreach is a startup that builds a digital experience platform. And the idea is to use data and machine learning to power consumer experiences or digital experiences broadly on any website or online experience. And so part of the product that I worked on quite a bit was the search product. And the idea was, how can we use data and machine learning to power a great personalized and highly relevant search experience for our customers? So kind of in a nutshell, like the way I would summarize my experiences, I love working on machine learning, AI, and build great consumer experiences leveraging machine learning and AI.
That's a good thread to have through your career. I think it served you well, and it will continue to. And I guess that brings you to the Yes. So you spent quality time working for Microsoft and Google. It's two of the bigger tech giants out there, two of the biggest. What are some similarities and differences of the engineering cultures of those two organizations?
Yeah, obviously, both Microsoft and Google are great companies, and I really enjoyed being at both places, and I learned a lot from both places. Some of my key learnings on how to build and run engineering teams has come from those places. And there's actually a lot of similarities between the two. So both companies really value technology. Both companies really value people and talent. They're really both focused on hiring and retaining the best technical talent and they do a great job of it, which is what makes these companies so fun to work for, because you're really surrounded by smart people. Of course, I left a long time back, and so things might have changed, but I think there's maybe a couple of differences that I noticed when I was there. One is that Google is a more bottoms-up driven culture. And so as an engineer, you have more leeway on what you work on. And so you end up actually working on a lot of interesting technology, and you know, you build a lot more technical infrastructure at Google because engineers are able to kind of take a lot of decisions on what they're working on. Microsoft, on the other hand, is more business driven. And so as an engineer, you're working on more projects that are directly tied to end business metrics. And so, you know, there's pros and cons of both. And, you know, it's kind of, that's one of the differences. The other difference I think is that the way Google's culture is set up is it's very collaborative. And so they, from its very start, they had this concept of peer reviews and the idea that it was very important what your other teammates thought about your work. And so the whole system is built around that. And that kind of leads to a more collaborative culture. But, you know, I think both of those companies do a great job of building very strong technology and very strong teams.
Yeah. You also spent a very long time as a CTO of a Silicon Valley grown up Bloomreach, right? So where you'd been responsible for building out their machine learning-based search product. So how did you go about doing that, right? And what did you learn from the step there? And maybe how does that relate to the Yes Now?
I was CTO at Bloomreach for almost 5 years. And Bloomreach started off as a company that had a SEO product, but then quickly built a number of other products to cover the whole digital experience for our customers. And so one of the products, as you mentioned, that I was involved in was the search product. And the way the search product started was that we started working with one of our retail customers, a pretty big retailer, who was interested in reimagining the user experience. And so we worked very closely with that customer to jointly actually rethink how we would build search, how we would change the user experience, what new technologies we would use. And we built a prototype for them. It was a small team of about five engineers. That was their whole focus was kind of reimagining search for this one customer. And so as part of that, we did a lot of innovation around the core search technologies, you know, whether it's leveraging AI or machine learning for different aspects of search, but also kind of reimagining the user experience of how search should look like, you know, whether it should be a single list of products, should there be new functionality that we should add. So there, it was kind of a phase where there's a lot of innovation happening. And that's actually pretty unique and fun to do, where you have the opportunity to work with one real customer to really rethink a product area. And then, you know, we launched that product on that customer, and obviously, you know, was fairly successful, and then started scaling it out so that we could actually sell it to more customers and increase our customer base. You know, it was a very fun thing for me to learn the journey from going from an idea to a full-fledged enterprise product and seeing that whole cycle. There's a large number of learnings for me in that process. A lot of those learnings were related to how you build enterprise products, how you think about the go-to-market. You know, and one key learning was that you always underestimate the complexity of building an enterprise product, that the core technology is just part of the challenge. There's a lot more challenges around actually scaling that technology so that it can meet the needs of all of your customers. But there were also some other interesting things that came out of that experience that, you know, are more applicable to the Yes, you know, which is more of a consumer company. So, for example, you know, one of the things that I took away from that experience is that in order to really change the customer experience, you can't just focus on the algorithms of the AI or the machine learning. You have to really think holistically about the user experience. So you have to think not just about the AI technology, but you also have to think about how you would change the consumer experience to bring that AI technology to to the users in a meaningful way and also get their feedback. So it's consumer experience is an end-to-end journey. You can't just focus on one part and make a big impact. So that was one learning that we've sort of carried over to the Yes. The other learning was that, especially as you scale to lots and lots of customers, you have to make the process of onboarding customers, or in our case, in the case of Yes, we have brand partners. You have to make the process of onboarding partners really seamless and easy and remove any friction. And you want to invest a lot in that, because if you don't do that, then it's going to be hard to scale. It's going to be hard to add more partners. So that was key. You know, you don't want to be spending a lot of time on the integration part. And we've spent learning has translated for me to investing a lot in that part of the product at the Yes. Yeah. And then the third learning for me was that domain knowledge is super important for building a really personalized experience, that, you know, building a great personalized experience that works across all the different domains, from fashion to furniture to commodities is not the right approach, that you need to start with a specific vertical and focus on it.
Understand. And we will talk about the Yes in a minute. Before we go there, you had one more stop in your career before you started co-founding the Yes. And actually there you took a very different hat on than you had at least from the title, right? That you had in your previous role, because you started as an entrepreneur in residence at Bain Capital Ventures. So what did you do there, and what was your role as as an entrepreneur in residence?
Yeah, you know, the entrepreneur in residence role varies a lot from venture firm to venture firm. I was lucky enough to have Bain as a sponsor, and they gave me a lot of leeway in what I could do. The high level idea of that role was that I was trying to start a company. That was the main idea. Beyond that, there were very little constraints for me on how I was spending my time. And so I actually ended up spending my time at Bain doing three things, all with the goal of eventually starting a company. So number one, I spent a lot of time catching up on technology. And so, you know, at Bloomreach, when you are in a very operational role and you're managing a big team, I feel like I didn't have enough time to catch up on the latest advances in technology. And so when I was at EIR at Bain, I spent a bunch of time learning about blockchain as an example, partly because I was just curious, but partly because I wanted to explore the idea of maybe there's an opportunity there to start a company. So I spent time learning about new advances in machine learning, blockchain, and other things that I thought I needed to catch up on. Number two, I spent a lot of time exploring markets that I thought were potential areas to start a company, that I thought were potentially ripe for disruption. So for instance, you know, one of the markets that I spent a bunch of time on was supply chain management. And is there something that can be disrupted by bringing AI to the decision-making process? And then finally, I spent a lot of time meeting other entrepreneurs and potentially co-founders. So one of my goals at Bain was to find a co-founder. I really believe that if I started a company, I would do it with someone because it's such a long journey that you want a partner. So those are the three things that I spend my time doing, all with the goal of starting a company.
I love that model of having an entrepreneur in residence, because you're right, when you're actually running a company on a day-to-day basis and you have hands-on operational responsibilities, it's hard to go back and really dig down and, you know, get out your favorite IDE and start coding and play around with things and learn.
Exactly.
And it's just a nice way to step back a little bit and, you know, sharpen your skills and figure out what you want to do next.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're entrepreneur in residence at Bain. How did you then find your co-founder Julie and found the Yes? So what was that? What was the founding story?
Yeah, so I was at Bain, as I said, and I was looking for potential ideas to start a company. I was looking for co-founders, and it was actually through Bain that I got introduced to Julie Bornstein, my co-founder. So Julie is a veteran of the retail industry. She you know, built the Nordstrom business, you know, almost 15 years back. She was chief operating officer at Stitch Fix, and she'd left Stitch Fix around the same time that I'd left Bloomreach, and she was also exploring starting a company, and she was looking for a technical co-founder. And so, I'd worked in the retail space for a long time, I was not necessarily looking at retail as a area, but she had a specific vision around building this next generation shopping experience that was powered by AI and machine learning and much less overwhelming to the consumer than what existed today. And so we started talking. Obviously, I was interested in the area. I'd spent a lot of time building search, personalization, consumer technologies over the years. And so it was definitely very intriguing to me. I'd also worked with a lot of brands and retailers at Bloomreach, and so I understood sort of the challenges and the opportunities. So we started talking about her idea of building this next generation shopping experience. We spent about 4 months discussing the idea, getting conviction on it, but also more importantly, getting to know each other. Starting a company is a process where you're trying to kind of validate the market, whether the market exists. In our case, the market did exist, but we were, for example, trying to validate if brands would be open to a new platform. We're trying to validate if consumers are looking for a new experience, and do they find the current experience overwhelming? So there was some consumer validation. And then there was just validation whether we wanted to spend the next 10, 20 years of our life working together. It's just a process that takes time. And so we spent 4 months going through that process and finally decided, number one, that the market opportunity was enormous. That's sort of one of the most important things when you're starting a company, is that you want to go after a big market. Number two, that there was a huge opportunity to build something that was very differentiated from a product and a technology perspective. And that was important to me because I'm a technology person. There's tons of startup ideas, but what was important to me was that what we build is something that is mainly a product and a technology company. And then finally, we felt like together we could build the team to accomplish it. And Julie obviously has a lot of experience in the space, and I felt like I could build the technology team to accomplish what we had in mind. And we decided to start the company and raise our first round.
Yeah, that's a great story. And, again, the entrepreneur in residence approach there really worked well. They almost served as a matchmaker between you, gave you some money. And it was a nice way of, being able to spend that quality time together without having to ship a product next week.
Exactly.
It's very valuable to have that. So one of the first decisions you must have made was to go app only. And that surprised me a little bit. And I like it. I was pleasantly surprised. But how did that discussion go? How did you and Julie decide that you wanted to do app only versus app plus web, or just web for that matter?
Yeah. It's interesting that you kind of brought this up, because we actually think of it as a major decision and like one of the first few major decisions that we took at the company. And the decision came down to two things. One was, we believe that there's a trend towards more and more users using their phones for shopping. And we believe that the trend will continue, that while, still a big chunk of commerce and shopping happens on the web, we believe that the phone and the app is going to get more and more of the share going forward. So that was number one. And number two was, we believe that if we built a product that worked well with the constraints of the phone and the constraints of the app, and that the users love that product, that we could more easily build a web-based product. The flip side was not necessarily true, that if you build a great web product, it was not clear to us that we could build a great app product after that. And so those were kind of the two things. And so the decision we took was not that we're going to be app only. The decision that we took was we're going to be app first. So we're still going to build a website eventually, probably sometime next year. But we had to make a call as a startup whether we'll build the app first or the website first. And so because of these two reasons, we went with the app.
You just mentioned it, that the Yes is built as an AI-powered shopping platform. So can you elaborate a little bit on what AI is used, and also why do you call it a platform? I think you already touched a little bit on that, but maybe we can dig a little bit deeper here.
The Yes actually uses AI in many different ways. I mean, I'm a big believer that AI is not a technology that should impact just one part of your business. It's something that should impact every part of the business. But the core purpose we use AI for is to drive personalization experience for the user. We use computer vision and NLP. Those are the two big things we leverage. For example, what we do with computer vision and NLP is that we take every product and we automatically assign more than 500 attributes for that product. So every product in our catalog, by just using the image and the description of the product, we can tell about 500 different attributes for the product. So we can tell, you know, what the color is, what the style is, what the category is, what the sleeve length is, what the sleeve type is, what's the fit of the product. So it's a really deep understanding of every product that we get. And then we encode a style for every product. So we kind of create, in very technical terms, we create a vector for every product that encodes its style so that we know if two products are similar in style or far away in style. And then we, use this deep knowledge of products to match users to products. And again, there we build a machine learning model for every user. And one of our core theses for the business is that, you know, today e-commerce is, if you go to any e-commerce website, it's a single store, and that single store is for every user. Mm-hmm. What we want to build, our vision is to build this unique store for every user. So if you have a million users,
you have a million stores.
Million different stores for those million users. And so we kind of build a unique machine learning model for every user that tells us, you know, what that user would like. So really, AI is at the core of our personalization algorithm and at the core of what we call this concept of a store built around the user. So that's the main way we use it.
How would you define AI in your terms, right? So there's in many podcast episodes, we started to discuss the topic with some of our guests. And right, there I would say, sometimes slightly different interpretations between, is it machine learning? Is it more around neural networks? So how would you define AI?
Yeah, I think I define it kind of broadly in a, not necessarily the go-to expert on this, but the way I think about it for our business is that AI is any system that can learn to do a task from data. The key here is that you're not encoding the algorithm, but you're just providing that system data so that it can now learn how to perform the task. And if the system is working well, it gets better with time as you give it more data. So to me, the key differentiating feature of an AI system versus, you know, kind of any other technology is that it's really driven from data, and it can learn from data, and it can improve as you give it more data. Go ahead.
So one of the challenges that a lot of our customers have is the product catalog feed, right? So getting data into the platform on the products. And typically they're struggling to get name and description and a couple images. So how did you get your suppliers to give you all of that data? And it sounds like you get some of it from image recognition, which is great, right?
Yeah.
But how do you get all of that extended product catalog data? Because it's pretty impressive what you have.
Yeah, one of the early decisions that we took, and this actually goes back to the platform part of your question. So one of the early decisions we took was, you know, we have two sort of stakeholders. We have the end users, and we're kind of building a platform for the end users. But, you know, we also have brand partners, and we're going to do everything to build a very friendly platform for the brands. And part of building something that's very friendly for the brands is so that we don't ask them to do a lot of work. And so one of the early principles of the product was, we're only going to ask them to give us really the raw data, title, description, product, pricing, and imagery, and that everything else we're going to extract using machine learning. And so, you know, today we don't ask them to give us extended attributes. We don't ask them to give us any taxonomy or any categorization of products. All we ask them is for the core data around the title, description, price, and imagery, and everything else we automatically extract using our technology.
So, and did you have, Do you have human editors that then go through and verify all of that, or how do you approach that?
Most of it is really automated. Like we can have human editors where, you know, there might be cases where, for example, there's no way we can be sure about the category of a product. In those cases, we'll pass it automatically to a human editor. But 99% of the cases, we don't have to do that. In 1% of the cases where there's some doubt in the algorithm, we automatically get it QA'd. So all of that is fully automated, fully scaled out.
That's impressive. And how many products are we looking at just in terms of scale?
We're looking at order of hundreds of thousands of products across all of our partners.
That's really impressive, by the way. I know that's always been a challenge, is trying to get the brand partners to upload correct product data. And it's a frustrating back and forth. So if you can do that in an automated way, I mean, that right there is a company by itself.
Right. We always say that, you know, over the last 2 years, we've kind of built multiple tech companies within the Yes. One other point I would add here is there's obviously the machine learning and AI technology to extract extended data. But we also spent a lot of time kind of thinking about how to get the data, even the title description imagery, from our brand partners. So obviously we've invested in plugins. You know, Shopify is a platform that's often used, so we have a plugin there. And we can process feeds, but we can also, if needed, really use technology to go crawl the data and extract the data that we need automatically.
Yeah. Another question is, so you have all these data attributes, right? All these product attributes, 500 of them at least, right? That's a lot of data. But part of the value is you're matching those products back to individual shoppers. So on day one, you don't, in theory, have any public users. How do you have enough data to train the models so that you can match people's preferences back to the products, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when we think about AI and machine learning problems, I think there's two buckets of problems. There's the, problem where we're taking a product and tagging it with data. There, you don't need a lot of user data. You can actually use manual tagging both internally. So we have domain experts that help us do that, but we can also scale that out. I think that the problem that you're talking about is more of the matching problem, where we have users and how do we match products to users. So I think we've done a few different things because we didn't have data in the past 2 years before we launched the product. So number one, we have a lot of internal users who are shoppers. So, you know, more than 50% of the company is women. We're targeting, our initial product is women's fashion. And so we've had a lot of internal users who've been playing around with the product for the last 2 years. We also have had about 500 beta users for a long time that have been on the product from a very early iteration of the product. So that's one source of data that we've been using. The other principle as we build the product, this is where we believe we've kind of innovated a lot, is we've really focused on how you personalize the user's experience using a small number of data points from the user rather than relying on a large number of data points. So the kind of the algorithms that we've built are using that principle. Traditionally, when you think about personalization, it's people think about collaborative filtering. You need a lot of data for collaborative filtering because you need to do inferences saying, you know, people who did this also did this. So you need a lot of scale and a lot of users to do that. But the approach that we've taken to personalization is more content-based. So we're not trying to say users who did this also did this. We're trying to understand the content of the product. We're trying to understand the preference of the user, either by asking them the right questions or providing them easy ways to give us feedback, and then matching the two based on content. And our theory is that, you know, if you do that, you can actually personalize with less data. So I think that the answer to your question is, number one, we've had internal users and beta testers for a while, and that the approach that we're taking to personalization is more content-based rather than user behavior data-based.
That actually led to some gamification in shopping, right? So when we're So your launch is now 6 weeks old. So is there any interesting data that you can already share around engagement, conversion rates, I don't know, basket size? Something that relates to where you said, okay, different way how you approach personalization. Do you also see different outcomes on user behavior?
I think we've pretty early, but the initial data is super encouraging. I think it tells us that the users are engaging with the product and really resonate with the value proposition. And maybe share two specific data points that might provide your audience some insights into what we're doing. So number one is, the way the product works is that you come in and you sign in. So you have to sign in with your email or your
phone. Yeah, I have a question actually on that. Maybe we can also elaborate there, right? Because it's a little doorkeeper, right? So you have the little burden of leaving your phone number to get verified and email. Is this a barrier? Do you see that their sign-up rates would be higher if it would be anonymously?
That's the data point I was going to share, is that what our data shows is that there's very little drop-off. When we initially started building the product and we talked to beta users, the feedback that we got was they were willing to share information if they thought it would help. Mm-hmm. And so, the data point that we got after launch is the completion rate is fairly high. Once a user installs the app, a big percentage of those users go through the sign up and complete the questionnaire. Part of this, by the way, one learning is if you look at the product, we don't have username or passwords. Our sign up is purely based on either your phone number or your Facebook Connect or Apple ID. And so that's actually, that removes a lot of the friction in the signup flow. I mean, a lot of the friction comes in when you ask users to create a new username and password. But that aside, I think one of the data points that's interesting is we don't see much of a drop in the signup flow that users do complete the signup flow. Obviously, that's something that we watch very closely and will continue watching. So that's one data point. The other data point that is interesting is we have this feature in the product where every place you see a product, you can yes or no it. So you can provide us feedback on whether you like the product, you don't like the product. And the idea is that we want to get more explicit data points from users because we believe that explicit data points are better for personalization. And so we want to get the user's feedback. Like our philosophy is we want to build a product where we're listening to users, users can give us feedback and we're learning from it and we're improving all the time. And so a core part of that experience is this yes and no button that's on every product. And we were really surprised pleasantly by the amount of engagement on that feature of providing us feedback. So in a short period of time after the launch, we've had more than 1 million data points where users have told us whether they like a product or not like a product. That's kind of way beyond what we expected it to be. And so that's a big opportunity for us to further improve the user's experience, because what it tells us is that users are very willing to share data and tell us where we're doing well and not doing well.
By the way, I love the experience, and I'm waiting for the men's version to come out because it's only women's right now. So I will be on your beta test list if you need some testers.
Definitely.
As you've really reinvented the shopping experience, that's great. So related to that, who else do you look at in terms of peer companies that you look up to? So for example, Julie came from Stitch Fix, right? There's Farfetch out there. There are a lot of other... I shouldn't say a lot. There are a handful of other startups out there trying to pioneer the reinvention of shopping. Who do you look to and why?
Yeah, I think, actually the great thing is that there's a lot of innovation happening in this space. Even if you compare it to maybe 5 years back, there's just a lot more startups and companies. Obviously, Stitch Fix is one of the pioneers in the personalization space. Lyst is a company that has innovated a lot in the search, and so they've built some really good technology for search in the shopping space. I think we've, over the course of the last 2 years, we've talked to a large number of really cool startups that are building AI technology. A lot of these startups are B2B businesses, but still building really interesting technology. But one of the companies that actually we get a lot of inspiration from is Spotify. So Spotify is not in the shopping space, but you know what Spotify has done is a few things. They've kind of really figured out how to leverage humans and machines together to really understand music and build a great personalized playlist for every user. And so in some ways, we see ourselves as an analogy in the shopping space where we want to really leverage human expertise and machines together to understand products, fashion, style, and then build a personalized store for each and every user, just in the way that you have a personalized playlist for you. And so, you know, we've kind of been inspired by that model. In some ways, we're trying to apply that model to e-commerce.
I love what you're doing, and we're big fans, and we'll continue to support you in any way we can. So thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Very much appreciated it.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Yep. Thanks, Amit. Thanks for everybody who was listening to the episode. Have a great day.